Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. It's Monday morning. We're going to do the Monday morning movie reviews coming up. Also, Eric is back from Toronto, and we'll do a final wrap-up. He'll tell us all about some of the other great movies and or not-so-great movies that he saw while he was up in Toronto at another fest. That's coming up. Also, my dad's going to call in and tell a jokey time. It's sponsored by the greatest restaurant on the planet, the Gale Street Inn. And, of course, we're going to talk about the Emmys and recap the winners and the losers and the highlights and the lowlights of the show. And I would love to hear from you guys with talk or text of your thoughts of last night's Emmy Awards. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you want to talk or text us. So, all right. Every week, as you know, Eric Childress and Colin Suter join me to review all the new movies. And Eric also gives us live reports from festivals that he goes to throughout the year. And again, he's going to give us a wrap-up of the Toronto Festival, which he just returned. So let's bring the guys on. Here's Eric. Hello, Eric.
Hey, man.
And Colin. Hey, Colin.
Hello there.
Hey. All right. Before we get we've only got a couple of movies to talk about this week. And of course, we'll do the box office, Eric, and you can give us a wrap-up on the Toronto Festival. But we, it would be remiss if we did not talk about Harry Dean Stanton, who passed away over the weekend at the age of 91. And it was one of the best character actors ever, one of the coolest dudes ever in general. And I just wanted to, I thought we could share our thoughts about Harry Dean Stanton and some of his work. Eric, why don't you go first?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Harry Dean Stanton is one of those guys that, you know, when he was old when I was young, you know, I mean, he always seemed, you know, up there. So, well, you know, obviously the first time I ever saw him was Alien. Mm-hmm. That was my first experience. And even though he doesn't last very long in that movie, I mean, clearly there, you know, he does leave an impression. And then you start to see him just kind of pop up. Like, he's not a guy that I, you know, necessarily went looking for in films, but he always just seemed to be kind of there. And it was, you know, it was one of those warm blanket type feelings that you knew that, you know, him being a part of something was something interesting was going to happen, whether it be Escape from New York or something simple like Christine, until later on when he discovers something like Paris, Texas, and, you know, obviously this year with Lucky. So, I mean, it's just, it's, he like you said, he's just one of those guys that, you know, always just was going to give you something to watch, you know, even in the middle of something that might not necessarily the film itself might not be as memorable, but he was always going to present you with someone that was going to be memorable just because it was him.
Yeah. Yeah. Colin, what about you? You have favorite performances?
Wow, it's hard to say. I mean, you know, Paris, Texas is pretty obvious, of course, and but you know, it is definitely, I mean, it was kind of written for him, as was his last film, Lucky, or one of his last films, I should say. IMDb has something else listed coming up that he's in, so it might be his penultimate film. But I mean, we at RogerEbert.com, we kind of did a little tribute piece. So a bunch of writers, you know, just kind of contributed a paragraph or two about, you know, who he was and what he meant and everything. And, you know, it all seemed to me like he was, I think he was definitely one of the first character actors I ever noticed when I was a kid growing up, and may have started with Christine. I don't really remember, but, you know, whenever he'd pop up, you know, it would bring something, you know, different to the film, just kind of a magical quality. Your eyes are always drawn to him. And I wrote that he was kind of his own kind of everyman, and that he may have, it's like he played every man that you can think of throughout his long, you know, diverse career. You know, he was the cop, he was the space traveler, he was the derelict, he was the barfly, he was the loner in the desert, and, you know, the estranged brother, and the cowboy, and the poet, and, you know, and just he could disappear into all these roles. And it was, and when you watch it, it's like, well, of course that's who you'd get to play that part. You got to get Harry Dean Stanton to play that part. And I can't think of a better career closer, even if it's technically not a closer, but Lucky is a film that's coming out soon. And I know we'll review it again, because we already kind of reviewed it a few months ago. But what a perfect way to kind of close this life, not just the career, but this life. The guy just did it all, and it was just amazing to watch.
Yeah, the fact that Lucky is opening October 6th at the Music Box, is that
correct?
Yeah.
Mark the date, people, because you're going to want to see this movie. And it's amazing that this film is being released so soon after his passing.
Yeah.
It's going to be a hard movie to sit through again, really hard. Especially, that final shot is going to be, off
right.
the charts. But he was one of these guys that, like, as you guys mentioned, he had a very long career, and it was, he did TV, he did movies. He was so great in Big Love, along with the late, great Bill Paxton.
Yeah.
He was great on that. He was great in everything that he did. He was great in Twin Peaks. He was just, he was fantastic. Some of my favorite performances, obviously, I think the grand performance for me, besides Lucky, which is the film that is probably the ultimate part of his entire career. Seriously, it is. But Paris, Texas is obvious, very, very obvious. But there's some other things that he was in. I love him in Escape from New York. I think he's fantastic. His brain. I love him in a lot of other stuff. But I wanted to mention She's So Lovely, which is an underrated movie that Travolta and Sean Penn and Robin Wright, and it was directed. I think Nick Cassavetes directed it, right? And it was his father's.
Yeah.
It was his father's
yeah.
script. It's not a great. It's not a perfect movie. There are things in it that I really. But he is phenomenal and hilarious in it. I don't know if you guys. Do you guys remember him in it?
God, this is like the ultimate irony that I like that movie,
yeah.
and I don't remember him being in that.
Oh,
movie.
He's hilarious in it. Is just he's so good in it. It's one of my favorite of his supporting performances. Wild at Heart, he was in. He was great in that. You guys, Last Temptation of Christ, he was fantastic in that. He's been doing so much great work. And there was a Christmas movie that he was in called One Magic Christmas with Mary Steenburgen, where he basically played an angel. And that's also one of my favorite performances. Anything that he did well. And he was also quite funny. And and one of my favorite comedic performances of his is in Young Doctors in Love. He's so hilarious in that movie. And like really ridiculously. I actually think that's a very fun. It might be my favorite Gary Marshall movie. Young Doctors in Love.
Really?
Yeah, it might. Well, I don't know. No, he's made other movies that are. But
yeah.
I think Young Doctors in Love is. I think Young Doctors in Love is very funny. But he's my favorite. He's my favorite performance in that movie. But the thing about Harry Dean Stanton that we need to remember was just not what he did on, not what he did in the movies or on TV, but how iconic he became as a guy. Just like how many actors just revered him so much and hung out with him, and he could sing and play guitar, and he was just like this iconic cool guy that went beyond just being a character actor, and I think the quintessential Harry Dean Stanton character is Repo Man, is his character in Repo Man, which is just an astonishingly funny performance, really, really great. I can't picture anybody on earth playing that role in Repo Man other than Harry Dean Stanton. And that's kind of what you can say about almost every part the guy played. Like, he made every part his own. And as soon as, the movie or the TV show was finished and he was in it, you would go, nobody else could play that role except that guy. And, the acting world has lost, a massive, massive talent, and we're lucky, no pun intended, that Lucky will be released, and it's going to have a whole, it already is. You guys know this already. It's this incredible portrait of this character and the real life actor and the man. And now it's just going to have so much more significance when it comes out. I mean, it's going to mean so much more, and it already means a ton. I mean, it'd be interesting to see. Have you guys read? Did the writers or John Carroll Lynch make a statement about his passing?
I haven't seen anything yet.
Yeah.
I reached out to the writers a bit, but I haven't heard back from them yet.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I haven't seen anything official.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would. I would recommend people who want to know more about Harry Dean Stanton, the man, to check out a couple documentaries. One is, I think, one we talked about on the show a few years ago called Partly Fiction, which is also, you know, kind of follows him around and also talks about his singing and his music. And he sings in that movie as well. And what's funny is Mark Maron's podcast, WTF, he reposted his interview with Harry Dean Stanton from a couple of years ago. And he was not an easy guy to interview. He was a tough interview.
Yeah.
He was like Harrison Ford in many, many ways, you know, not divulging very much, one word answers and such. And the director of this film, Partly Fiction, assured Mark Maron that, no, you did fine. It's not you. It's him. That's what you're going to get. That's what everybody gets. And then there's another documentary made by one of the writers of Lucky. It's a documentary called Character that came out in 2009. Drago Samonja, who co-wrote the movie Lucky, he made this documentary with it's got Harry Dean Stanton and Dabney Coleman and Peter Falk and Charles Grodin and Mark Rydell and Sidney Pollack all talking about acting. And it's a collection of interviews with these guys. And it's very, really interesting stuff. So people should check those two movies out if they want to know a little bit more about Harry Dean Stanton.
Yeah, good call. Okay, we had to honor the Harry Dean Stanton. You guys hang on, okay?
Uh-huh.
All right, Eric Childress and Colin Suter are here. We've got a couple of new movies to talk about, and we'll do that. Plus, Eric will give us a wrap-up of the Toronto Film Festival, and we'll talk about the weekend's box office. All that and more after we take a break here for the news on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. How are you? We're live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. Here till 5 a.m., Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5, and Steve Cochran at 6. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. We're going to be covering the Emmys and getting your response to the show and to the winners and all that cool stuff. That'll be coming up. But right now it's time for our movie reviews, the Monday morning movie reviews with Eric Childress and Colin Suter. And we welcome Eric back. Welcome back, Eric.
Thank you.
And Colin. Welcome back, Colin.
Hello.
Okay, Colin, why don't you start us off with American Assassin?
All right. Well, this film stars Dylan O'Brien as a guy named Mitch Rapp. And at the start of the film, Mitch is proposing marriage at a beach resort, the location of which I don't think is ever mentioned. And suddenly a band of terrorists come out shooting everyone down, and she dies and he doesn't. And then we cut to a year and a half or 2 years later, and he's trained himself to be a kind of special ops agent, hell-bent on personal revenge against the terrorist who killed his girlfriend. He's not working for anybody but himself, but he gets into their cell by posing as one of them, growing a long beard and everything, and infiltrating them, which catches the attention of the CIA, who've been kind of keeping track of this guy. And so they finally just bring him in and basically recruit him. He's against the idea of being recruited, because it means he has to follow rules, but he goes through with it, and Michael Keaton plays the man in charge of all this, and so Mitch has to take orders from him. And when they actually go out into the field, after I don't know how much, weeks or months of training, Mitch has a hard time not going rogue and doing things his way and not following orders. And eventually the plot gives way to, an even more standard thriller involving suitcase nukes and random attacks on military targets and trying to track down where that's coming from and so on and so forth. So this is, you know, you look at the title American Assassin and you kind of paint a picture of what that movie is in your head. And this one is probably the one you're going to paint in your head. And it offers very little in the way of surprises, but even more frustrating, it offers very little in the way of substance for this character and why we should care about him. Yeah, it opens with him and at a resort, and he's proposing to his girlfriend and holding his phone up as a, you know, taking this selfie video of him doing it, and that's what we watch. And then the guns come out and kill everyone. But, you know, then when we cut to a year and a half later and he's being interrogated, you know, there's just some little expository dialogue about his parents being killed, you know, when he was younger. And but there's still just not enough to go on to keep us really rooting for this guy. That would be okay if the script were a little tighter and a little more, you know, had a little more originality to it. But it's got four writers. It's based on a novel by Vince Flynn, and it's got four writers. But it feels like it was written by one screenwriter who took one shot at the screenplay and they filmed that. And this would also be okay if Dylan O'Brien had any kind of, you know, was brought something to the role that would make us believe that this guy is capable of doing all this stuff. He doesn't really have much in the way of, you know, brooding intensity that would make a less defined character interesting. Instead, he doesn't come off as an action star. To me, he seems like an intern at NPR, and that's a problem. I just don't buy it. It's just bad casting, I think. And, you know, Michael Keaton does what he can and, you know, he's clearly the best thing in the film. He's clearly the most fun to watch, but even he still kind of just seems like he's phoning it in a little bit, except for the end. I think there's some fun moments there. But it's not enough to make it worth really plucking down the money and buying a ticket. It gets a little more interesting at the end when, you know, we get into more sort of end-of-the-world stuff. But by then, there's just nothing to really invest in. I thought this was a pretty standard, pretty generic film that pretty much evaporated from my brain as soon as it was over.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%, Colin. This is a real forgettable movie, and it's too bad. If you guys remember, when we did the fall preview, this is one of the ones that I was looking forward to, simply because of Michael Keaton, and he is absolutely the best thing in it. And I had no idea who this Dylan O'Brien guy was.
Me neither.
he's Teen Wolf. And he was in the Maze Runner movies,
which I've never seen.
Yeah, so I don't know. Are you familiar with his work, Eric? Before this,
I've seen some of the Teen Wolf stuff.
Yeah,
but I've never seen the Maze Runner movies either.
Yeah, none of us know who this guy is, essentially. I agree with you 100%. I love the intern at NPR reference. The guy's a zero on screen. Really, I mean, I agree with you 100%, Colin. The guy's very little charisma. I think he's hugely miscast as well. And it seems to me like Michael Keaton is trying to make up for what lacks in the script by kind of pushing it a little too far. You know, the action sequences are fine. You know, the fight scenes are kind of okay. But, you know, when you see something like Atomic Blonde or John Wick, I think the level has gone up now in terms of like hand-to-hand stuff and, you know, fight scenes and things like that, especially with John Wick and then that one long sequence in Atomic Blonde. They kind of pushed it to another level in terms of that hand-to-hand kind of combat action stuff. And this movie's sequences lack that kind of spark and that kind of fire to them. You know, the rest of the movie is standard. I just didn't care what was happening. The lead is really bland, and only Michael Keaton would be the only reason to even remotely see this movie. It's just generic, it's bland, and it's forgettable, which is not what you want an action movie to be. And so I'm not recommending American Assassin either. And Eric, you have not seen it, correct?
Not yet.
Okay.
Not yet.
All right, well, there you go. That's the movie number one. Now, the movie number two that we need to talk about. Eric, remind everybody about Mother.
Okay. Well, if you were listening last week, I got to see the premiere of this at the Toronto Film Festival last week, and this is a new film from Darren Aronofsky, and it stars Jennifer Lawrence and Javier Bardem as a married couple who live out in a home pretty kind of isolated in the country, a childhood home of Javier Bardem's that actually burned down when he was a child. Or at some point, and Jennifer Lawrence is helping him basically refurbish this entire thing, so it'll be their dream home, basically. He's I think he's a poet, I believe, in the film, and he's kind of going through a little Jack Torrance at the moment. He's going for a little, got a little writer's block going on, trying to find that bit of inspiration, and one night, possibly that walks through his door in the form of Ed Harris, who is a doctor who was led to believe that this home of theirs was a bed and breakfast. So he comes over, and Javier Bardem invites him to stay the night while he travel, you know, back out. And Jennifer Lawrence is not too keen on this. After all, he is a stranger. But, you know, as Javier Bardem says, well, he's a doctor. So that makes it all right. So he stays the night, and he's got some quirks. He's not exactly the most ideal house guest. He likes to smoke where he's not supposed to and pry, you know, into their lives a little bit. But things get even weirder the next day when his wife shows up. And that's Michelle Pfeiffer. And if you thought that he was the house guest that wouldn't leave, she is immeasurably worse, especially in prying into Jennifer Lawrence's, you know, why they don't want to have a child, how much she actually loves Javier Bardem, and things just get weirder from there. Needless to say, that's exactly where we kind of want to stop the plot description of this movie. And, you know, I mean, I said a bit about it at the festival, and I can't wait to hear your guys' thoughts on this. I mean, this is almost the kind of movie that we almost don't want to talk about without, you know, talking about exactly what this movie really is about. You know, but we don't want to spoil it for people either. Not like people are going to see this movie
right
at the moment. So what do we really care, frankly? Needless to say, as I think I described on the show last week, this is pretty much a living nightmare on the surface. You know, if you want to take away all the religious and environmental connotations and metaphors and all the things that we can delve into, certainly, and maybe we will tonight a little bit as well. If you just take it on the surface as this sort of horrific domestic home invasion to the extreme story, you have something, you know, that starts weird and quirky and uncomfortable, and then just goes to such extremes that, you know, even if you're not really enjoying the film, you have to admire the technical craftsmanship that's on display in the editing, the direction, the performances. Just trying to keep this all together, you know, is probably about as hard as it was for Christopher Nolan to put Dunkirk together and try to keep all the timelines, you know, moving at, you know, the exact same pace. And this is just a through line that just keeps going to the extent that you either want to run with it or close your eyes and run away from it. And like I said, I mean, there are all kinds of things that we can talk about with this movie, what it's really about, and we might all be completely wrong about it. There are people even at the premiere trying to interpret what, you know, the precious jewel in the movie is supposed to represent. Yeah. And Aronofsky was on stage and he goes, yeah, that's good. <You know? laughs> That's a good one. Go with that. And I think you're going to hear a lot of that from the people who are willing and want to talk about this movie. You know, I mean, we will bring up the box office later, but, you know, this is not one of those movies that needs to be measured or remembered for its box office. I mean, in fact, Paramount even came out with a statement today basically saying, like, yeah, we don't care. Like, you know, this is a movie that's going to be talked about by, again, the people who, you know, want to go with it.
that's going to be talked about for a long time. Mm-hmm. And I think that there are a lot of things with Aronofsky's personal life and sort of the grander statement that he's trying to make about religion and God and the environment and what it means to be a member of this planet that I think is going to be debated for a very long and treasured time, at least from the three of us,
yeah.
I imagine.
Yeah.
So,
all right.
I love this movie. I think it's one of the best movies of the year.
Okay, Eric, hang on. Colin, hang on. Okay, guys, we're talking about Darren Aronofsky's Mother. When we come back, we'll find out what Colin thought of it, and I'll tell you what I thought of it as well right here on 720 WGN. Oh, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. How's everybody doing this morning? It's Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a jokey time. And it's brought to you by the greatest restaurant on the planet, the Gale Street Inn. Check out galestreet.com. We're also obviously going to cover the Emmys, and we want to hear from you guys. What did you think of the show? What did you think of the winners, the losers, speeches, all that stuff coming up a little bit later on. 312-981-7200 is the phone number, and we're doing the Monday morning movie reviews. Not that much. We're only reviewing two movies this week, and before the break, Eric told us about Darren Aronofsky's new movie, Mother, with Javier Bardem and Jennifer Lawrence. And Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And now we want to find out what Colin, welcome back.
Hello there.
All right, Colin, what'd you think?
I recommend it. There we go. I'm done. No, this is not a movie where you go, yeah, did you like it? Should I go see it? I don't know. Sure. Take a chance. You will not have another experience like this at the movies for a long time if you've ever had one like this at all. It is very much, I mean, like, I agree with everything Eric said about just the watching of this film and the viewing of it. And if you just kind of sit back and be a passive viewer of it, you will still have an experience that is a visceral kind of tension that you're not used to feeling when you're watching a movie. I mean, it kind of just builds to this pitch that is really unnerving, and Aronofsky does a brilliant job of just keeping the audience on, of viewing all this through Jennifer Lawrence's eyes. The camera is on her almost all the time in this film, and almost always in close up. And so when you feel this anxiety, this tension, this nervousness about everything throughout the whole thing. You're right there with her. And I walked into this, hearing all the word of mouth ahead of time saying this is, you'll either love it or you'll hate it. But you'll be talking about it, you'll be trying to understand it. And so like my brain kind of went into, I kind of overthought it while it was happening. And, as it was going on, I'm like, oh, yeah, okay, I think I guess what's going on here. This represents this. This is about this. Oh, the house is the house alive? Oh, this is like Monster House by way of David Cronenberg. Oh, okay, that's a funny little quip. I can remember that. And then something would happen where I'd be like, wait a minute. Okay, never mind. It's not about that. Oh, maybe it's about this. And I'm just, but you're also having such a visceral experience that you don't have time or to think about what it is. And then when you think you haven't figured it out, then the end, you look at the end credits and you look at the characters' names like, oh, well, okay, maybe I was way off. you can't say, what this movie, like what Eric was saying, is really about, because you're not going to have the answer, the one answer. But I'm glad to hear Aronofsky's just kind of letting people go, yeah, okay, that's good. I'm glad to hear that, because that's the kind of experience this is. And you have to be up for that. You have to be up for that kind of a challenge. And this does not necessarily mean like, oh, if you're a cinephile, you'll love it because it gives you a lot to think about and it's different and it's not adhering to any formula whatsoever, because there are people who love, who review movies like us and who, just eat this kind of stuff up, who will come out of it saying it was pretentious, it was ridiculous, and Darren Aronofsky is being self-indulgent, and he's done this sort of thing before, and blah, blah, blah. I mean, there is no way for anyone to tell there's no way to tell if somebody's going to love or hate this film. It doesn't matter if you're a cinephile or not. You're going to have a kind of, your reaction will be genuine, I think, and understandable, I think. So this is a, you know, this is a movie where you can't just give a blanket thumbs up or thumbs down for if people are looking for a blanket recommendation from us. Certainly, I think it's one of the year's best films. Certainly, it could very well be on my top 10 list. We'll see. Certainly one viewing is not enough, and I'll see how I feel on my second viewing as well. But right now, I couldn't get this movie out of my head when it was over, and I'm still thinking about it. And I think that's what Darren Aronofsky wants you to do, and he's achieved that. So,
okay.
Yeah.
All right. Hang on. And when we come back, I'll tell you what I thought of it, and then maybe we can have a little round-robin discussion with the three of us trying to put the pieces together of this movie. When we come back, the news is up next, and then after the news, we will finish up this discussion of Darren Aronofsky's new movie, Mother, right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. How are you? We're live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower here till 5. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5. The great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It's Monday, and we are talking about the Monday morning movie reviews. Eric will also hang out. We'll talk about the box office for the weekend, and then we'll do a final wrap-up of all the films that he saw in Toronto. He just got back from the Toronto Film Festival, and we get an exclusive coverage from the festival movies. And my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, and we're going to talk about the Emmys from last night, the winners, the losers, your favorite moments, all of that cool stuff. That's all coming up right here on WGN. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can check us out on Twitter at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. Okay, before the break, Eric and Colin talked about the new movie Mother and gave us their thoughts. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Colin, welcome back.
Hey.
Okay. So I took my parents to this movie. And I just the end credits pop up, okay? The movie ends, written and directed by Darren Aronofsky, pops up on screen. My dad just turns to me and goes, well, that was different.
I want that on the poster.
That's exactly what he said. He just goes, well, that was different. And I just might say this right now. My parents liked it, man.
Good for them.
They dug it. They were with it. My mom especially dug it. Which I find fascinating, quite frankly. But we talked about it in the car afterwards, and they were on board with, interpretations of what it could be and what it is. And, clearly it was like as my dad said, it was a different experience, you know what I mean? I thought it was fantastic. I adore this movie. I absolutely loved it, and I think there is a lot of interpretation that you could throw in there. I think there's a lot of biblical stuff in there. I think there's also, the connection between an artist and his muse, and what that regard. I'm fascinated to find out what Rachel Weisz thinks of this movie. I really would love to to find out what she thinks of this film. On the simplest of levels, it's so beautifully made, and it builds to such an insane. This movie goes off the rails. I mean, the last third of this movie is completely insane, and I mean that in a great way. Beautifully insane. There's also, and I'm not going to give away who it is, but there's a fantastic, lovely casting surprise in this movie. Late in the film, somebody shows up that you would never expect to be in the movie. And it's an awesome little layer of weirdness. You know what I mean? That just, mm-hmm. Oh, you cast that person in this role?
Yeah.
Oh, you're going to go that crazy. Oh, I got it. Okay. And the build up, this stuff where, when people just start showing up at the house, I was going crazy. I was losing my mind. Just going from room to room and everything. And I was just like, how many times do you have to tell somebody to get off a sink?
Oh, God.
I can't even. My God, I was losing my mind in it. The anxiety. And then there's a split. I think the movie has two halves. There's this sort of straightforward, out of control, sort of domestic half. And then the second half of the movie goes completely into symbolism. Like, you know, I mean, you could get, the first half of the film is grounded in some base of reality. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The second half, it just like, what? What the hell is happening? And it just gets crazier and crazier. There are mind-blowing sequences in this in this movie. I, you know, there's so much on so many different levels that you can talk about it. But in terms of the way it's made, it's impeccable. It's beautifully directed. It's one of the best things that Aronofsky has ever done. The screenplay is really interesting and layered and all that stuff. I think Jennifer Lawrence is phenomenal in it, and it's a man, I, you know, I can't even imagine what, you know, what after a work day, what, what it was like for her to go back to her trailer. I can't even fathom what she went through emotionally and physically during the making of this movie. Javier Bardem is great in it and creepy and perfect casting. God, Ed Harris and Michelle Pfeiffer, man. Come on. There's a scene in the movie. There's a scene in the movie where she, because you know, as you said earlier, Eric, that Jennifer Lawrence's character is sort of rehabbing the house, and she's putting some spackle on a wall when Michelle Pfeiffer comes in with a couple of lemonades for him, and that's one of my favorite scenes in the entire movie. And it just goes a little bit. It just keeps getting creepier and creepier, and Michelle Pfeiffer just keeps getting stranger and more invasive and funnier. The build up to this and what happens, you know, in the house, not when just Michelle Pfeiffer and Ed Harris show up, a couple of other people show up, which is also intense and weird and biblical and very biblical. And, you know, I mean, taking all the Bible stories, I mean, this could be a companion piece, Eric, to Noah.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? In terms of theme, in terms of, you know, let's end this now and start all over again and whatever. So I adore this movie. Now, the audience that I saw it with, you know, in Skokie, you know, next to a Buffalo Wild Wings, were just kind of baffled, I think, by the whole thing. And there was a weird silence at the end. There were walkouts. The people were walking out during the last half hour of the movie when it all just kind of goes haywire. Just people were like, yeah, that's it. I'm gone. I can't deal with this anymore. So, but I loved it. It's a very visceral experience. It'll fill you with anxiety. It'll give you something to think about and to talk about afterwards. And that's kind of the most important thing. But, yeah. So what was the crowd like, Colin, when you saw it?
It wasn't so much of a crowd, but I mean, I saw it at the Evanston Theater like at 12:15 on Saturday, and the Evanston crowd is a little more hip to what Aronofsky does. So I don't recall anything in the way of walkouts, but people were pretty silent as they were walking out. So I think that this was probably the crowd. It wasn't a huge crowd either. So
yeah. No, we didn't have a huge crowd. Well, obviously, you know, looking at the numbers, there wasn't a huge crowd for this movie anywhere over the weekend. But it was certainly, I don't know, it's one of my favorite experiences of the year, movie-wise, and I just one of my favorite movies of the year. And Aronofsky continues to be just a fascinating filmmaker, really. I thought it was great. So, Eric, what do you think in terms of this thing has tanked, it's done. Paramount just said they don't care, right?
Yeah, they pretty much they actually came out with a statement. They said that it's not always about the money. That we're proud of this movie, we're proud of Aronofsky's vision, and you know it's okay if people don't like it.
Yeah,
that's basically what they said.
It's amazing the fact that that this movie has the Paramount logo at the beginning is astonishing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Especially after he made Noah for Paramount.
Yeah.
How did he convince them to make this after that, which is even more insane and less accessible and less mainstream than Noah?
Yeah.
I mean, man, does that guy know how to work a room?
Yeah, I guess so, man. I guess so. And but it's a special movie now. And again, you know, I can tell, you know, Dean Richards gave it an F. I mean, he absolutely hated it. He hated it. And I can understand, you know, people having extreme. Well, it's an extreme movie, so your reaction is going to be extreme.
Yeah.
But I can totally understand why people would hate this movie. I you know, and if I recommend it and someone sees it and says it's the worst thing I've ever seen in my life, I'd be like, okay.
Yes.
That's a legitimate response to this insane movie. But man, it's good.
It's only legitimate, we're talking seriously about that now, but you know, it's only legitimate to me if people are willing to at least have the conversation about it. I mean, I was at the premiere at Toronto.
Yeah.
And you know, you normally have a pretty sophisticated crowd at Toronto, and most of them seem to really be into the movie, frankly.
Yeah.
But there are people, and I was up in the balcony where they seem to be giving press people or industry people tickets, leftover tickets and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And there was like a group of three behind me, and the guy after got up, and after the movie was over, he said Paramount should be ashamed of themselves.
Oh man!
And I threw him off the balcony because that's the kind of talk. You know, I don't want to hear that kind of thing. It's like, yeah, I mean, if I took my mom to see this movie, she'd be incredibly uncomfortable.
Yeah.
About it. That's why I wouldn't bring her to it.
Yeah.
But she would have the conversation.
Yeah.
She'd go, what do you think that's about? And I'd explain it to her, and go like, oh. Okay, that makes sense, yeah. I think. I didn't really like the movie, but okay.
That was the conversation that I had with my folks afterwards in the car. It was a very interesting ride home. And I still think the greatest quote ever is my dad. It's when it was over. Well, that was different. And I was like, yes, it was. Yes, it was. All right, next week we got a bunch of movies opening. Battle of the Sexes opens, correct?
Yeah, it does, doesn't it?
Kingsman, The Golden Circle, the sequel to Kingsman, the Lego Ninjago movie. Stronger open next week?
Does open next week.
Okay, so some interesting stuff. Brad Status. Yeah. Brad Status opens next week.
Yeah.
Mike White's new movie. Lots of stuff next week to talk about. So,
Friend Request.
Oh, yeah. Let's not forget about that. Let's not forget about that. By the way, speaking of horror movies really quickly, have you guys seen the trailer for Happy Death Day?
No.
I don't know. If you look it up and watch the trailer, and I really, really think that Harold Ramis and Danny, I'm trying to remember the other screenwriter for Groundhog Day, Danny, whatever his last name is, they need to start getting checks cut to them. Yeah, because people are just going to, people are just going to keep remaking Groundhog Day with a different name every couple of months.
And that was a movie that was supposed to be the competition for Mother originally. Mother was supposed to open on October 13th.
Oh, I see. All right. Yeah. Okay. All right, Colin, thanks, man.
Yep. All righty.
Okay, man, we'll talk to you next week. And Eric, you hang on, okay? Eric Childress is going to hang out with us when we come back. We're going to talk about the box office, and then Eric will give us his final wrap-up of the 2017 Toronto International Film Festival. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Tribute Tower. Here till 5. Going to talk Emmys in a little bit, and my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it is Monday. We reviewed the new movies, and now we're going to talk box office real quickly and then jump right into the Toronto Film Festival. Eric just got back from that, and we're going to get more of his thoughts on some of the movies he saw while he was there. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Let's talk box office real quick here. Not a lot to talk about, really.
No.
It, $60 million, $218 million total. That would be a hit.
Yeah. This is a literal monster, this movie. This movie is headed for over $300 million. No film ever released in September or October has ever hit $300 million.
Wow.
The only films ahead of it right now are Gravity and The Martian.
Wow.
That's the box office category that this film belongs in. And it's going to pass The Martian this week. It's crazy.
Yeah.
I still haven't seen it. I'm looking forward to seeing it for myself, see where I end up on the spectrum.
Yeah.
But everybody is going to see this thing right now.
Yeah. And it's huge.
Yeah.
Number two, American Assassin, $14.8 million. Is that? That's about what everybody thought it would make.
Yeah, right? Yeah, it's kind of fine. It's not a really heavily budgeted film. $14, $15 million, that's about what they probably expected from this, especially with the drop-off of the next movie we're going to talk about. So it's going to end up in probably at the low 40s. And so if it makes a couple bucks overseas, it'll be fine for Lionsgate.
Okay. And then, of course, we were just talking about Mother.
Yeah,
$7.5 million. I was expecting a little bit more.
Oh yeah, and I think that the reviews might have gotten ahead of this. I mean, not like the reviews were really bad, But the headlines this weekend, you know, when you start the headlines this weekend, the fact that it got an F cinema score, which, you know, I mean, the cinema score is stupid, it's garbage, but, you know, it can be used as a barometer for box office longevity. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't really mean anything the opening weekend, but everybody led their stories to the fact that this thing got an F cinema score. You know, however many random people got, you know, surveyed for this thing, you know, and then it got that. And remember, I made a list of, you know, some of the movies that have gotten Fs over the year. Richard Kelly's The Box, William Friedkin's Bug, Soderbergh's Solaris. All these movies got Fs.
Yeah.
You know, so the, you know, these are, you know, different films, not exactly the most audience friendly films from major filmmakers that, you know, are going to outlive the 8 Tyler Perry movies that got A's from CinemaScore.
Right.
So, it's cinema, but that, but I think that probably, you know, people who, you know, maybe do pay attention to those things, you know, might have stayed away, but I mean, it's, you know, it's going to make less money than The House at the End of the Street, for God's sakes, which for Jennifer Lawrence.
Yeah.
And it's really, it's disappointing. I think that Paramount must be kicking themselves for moving the thing into the wake of It. I certainly don't think that helped it at all.
Mm-hmm.
There's one big horror movie out there that everyone's seeing, so why do we need another?
Yeah.
If they would have left it in the October slot, it could have been a pre-Halloween thing. They could have built a little bit more buzz. They, you know, played up the favorable reviews from Toronto a little bit. And, you know, maybe they could have gotten a $12 to $15 million opening and then watched the thing drop off massively from there, which is going to do next week, too.
Yeah, of course. Okay, so let's do a couple more here. Home Again, $5.3 million, $17 million in 2 weeks. At least Reese Witherspoon, you know, had a TV show that did very well last night.
Yeah, most certainly did. I haven't seen Home Again, but I guarantee you Big Little Lies is better.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, this isn't a mark on Reese Witherspoon either. This is a mark on Open Road Films, who just can't, you know, ironically, open films.
Yeah.
And that's just the way it is.
Okay. And then Hitman's Bodyguard comes in number 5. That's got a total of $70 million. I guess that's okay, right?
No, it's a kind of a surprise hit. I mean, $70 million, I don't think anyone was really expecting it to do that well. I thought they were probably thinking around somewhere between $40 and $50 million and the summer little release and thing like that. Hasn't opened internationally yet, so once the international dollars comes in, that's going to be a hit for them.
Okay. All right, well, that's your top 5. The rest of them, you know, got Annabelle Creation, Wind River, Leap, Spider-Man, Homecoming, still in the top 10.
Yeah.
And then Dunkirk, still in the top 10.
Yeah.
As well. All right. Okay, cool. Let's take a break here, Eric, okay?
Okay.
All right, we'll take a break, and then when we come back from the break, we will talk about the Toronto Film Festival and the rest of the movies that Eric saw. And that's all coming up right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. How are you? It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. We did our movie reviews, and we also did the box office. And Eric, who spent some time in Toronto at the Toronto Film Festival last week, did some live call-ins and updates from Toronto. Well, he's back, and now we're going to get a final wrap-up on the rest of the movies that Eric saw. Eric, welcome back, man.
Thank you.
All right, Toronto Film Festival, we've talked about a bunch of the stuff. Where do you want to start this morning?
Let's talk about probably the best film that we haven't talked about yet, and it's Sean Baker's The Florida Project.
So curious about this movie.
Yeah, this is a film that kind of made a big splash at Cannes this year, where it premiered. Sean Baker did the film Tangerine a few years ago, which was a film that was shot entirely on his iPhone. It was entirely shot on iPhones, I believe.
Yep.
And this film is, it's not really a film based in plot. I mean, it's basically sort of the daily lives of a hotel in Florida that basically acts as a place for basically lower class families who can afford weekly rent stay. You know, it's the kind of the thing you pass on the way to Disney World, basically, during in that part of the neighborhood. And it focuses mainly on some of the children in the place. There's a young mother and her young daughter who live there. We see a lot of things through the kids' eyes and sort of the rambunctious, you know, kind of ne'er-do-well behavior that they get themselves into. They're kids. You know, they're not exactly the greatest behaved kids. They're not exactly the greatest parented kids, but they are kids. So we see them going having their little adventures and then coming home and seeing exactly how they fit in with their families and things like that. Willem Dafoe plays the manager of the hotel who, you know, kind of has to corral a lot of these people together, chasing them down for rent, chasing down the kids, you know, fixing things where he can. But also, you know, having kind of a caring eye and, you know, he does get involved in these people's lives and does his best to look out for them. And it's the kind of performance that we really want to see Willem Dafoe do more of. I mean, it's a kind of a perfect role for him. I think he is going to get an Oscar nomination for this movie. He's really good. And it reminded me a bit, you know, there was a movie that came out last year called American Honey.
Yeah.
From Andrea Arnold. And this, in some ways, you could actually like view this as kind of maybe like a prequel to American Honey in a way, and sort of the daily milieu of the lives that this movie is dealing around. I think it's a lot better than American Honey. American Honey was a long movie with, I thought, more unpleasant characters. It will take you, you know, it took me a little bit to warm up to some of these characters, even the kids. Like you said, they're not exactly the most well-behaved children in the world. They do some pretty terrible things in this movie. But you warm up to them, and by the end of the movie, you're almost on the verge of tears, you know, where this movie eventually goes. But that's not to say that the movie isn't sort of really funny and full of life. And it's something that you're really going to be remembering the end of this movie for a while.
Okay. That's The Florida Project, which opens in November.
Yeah.
All right. The Florida Project. And it's nice to see Willem Dafoe get a good juicy part, you know, because he's so great.
He's so good in this movie, too. So good.
Oh, that's cool. All right. Where do you want to go next?
Let's go. Well, that movie has been released by A24, so why don't we stick with them? Because they also have a movie that's kind of snuck up on the festival circuit, Telluride and now Toronto. And it's the directorial debut of Greta Gerwig. It's called Lady Bird.
Mm-hmm.
And it stars Saoirse Ronan as a girl who is just about... she's getting ready for college. She's in between high school and college, and she wants more than anything to go out of state. She really wants to go to New York. She wants to go just get away and, you know, go somewhere that will get her away from Sacramento, where she lives with her parents, who are played by Tracy Letts and Laurie Metcalf.
Fantastic.
I know, seriously, right? I mean, it just seems at some point those two should be parents of somebody in the movie.
And Chicago represent, man.
So seriously,
yeah.
It's kind of crazy. Laurie Metcalf is so good in this movie. So good, like Oscar nomination good.
Mm-hmm.
And so is Saoirse Ronan, frankly. Greta Gerwig, definitely an indie staple at this point. I was not the biggest fan of Frances Ha, which she co-wrote. I wasn't a big fan of that movie at all. And Saoirse Ronan is basically, you know, the way I viewed it, is basically playing Greta Gerwig and has a lot of her affectations and her behavior and her style of humor throughout the film. So it's kind of like the way when people play Woody Allen in his movies.
Yeah.
That's kind of what you're getting here. So if the Greta Gerwig, you know, persona annoys you a little bit, then you might be put off a little bit. But that's really more sort of early on. Again, it's not a movie that is sort of plot-driven. It's a lot more character-driven. Again, Saoirse Ronan, Metcalf, really great in the movie. It's filled with its parts are filled out with a lot of really great actors. Lucas Hedges has a role. Timothy Chalamet, who again is in this movie called Call Me by Your Name, that we've been talking about since Sundance, that you're going to be hearing a lot about later this year. He has a role in the film. And again, it's a film that you don't get to see done well so often. That's stories about mothers and daughters, and the way they talk to each other and the way that their relationships can be in the same scene can be, you know, argumentative and comforting in the same moment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of thing that Ronan and Metcalf really play up very well in this movie. I think it's a solid debut from Gerwig behind the camera.
Good. I'm looking forward to it. I saw the trailer for it. I always, I'm going to miss Saoirse's accent though. Because I love her accent so much every time she opens her mouth. And when I see she's doing an American accent, I was like, oh.
Yeah.
But anyway, that opens, by the way, the same day as the Florida Project.
It does?
Yeah. They both open November 10th, according to IMDb.
Oh, maybe they moved the Florida Project then, because I still got it in October in Chicago.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe.
The Florida Project is going wider then, maybe.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Well, where do you want to go next?
Well, you know, when I left you last time, earlier in the week, I teased the fact that there was a crazy Nicolas Cage movie coming up around the bend.
Uh-huh.
And Toronto played a film called Mom and Dad.
Mom and Dad.
Yes.
All right.
And it stars Nicolas Cage and Selma Blair on a day when something causes all of the parents in the country, or at least in this town, to basically turn on their children in a murderous way.
Mm.
Okay. Now, immediately, people are already turning off the radio because it's not, you know, when you talk about it like that, nobody wants to see that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not a plot that sounds appetizing. It's not a plot that we really want. We don't really want to see a bunch of children mutilated. We see too much of that in society. But for somehow the director of this film, if you don't know who it is, I'll tell you about it in a minute, does manage to kind of have his cake and eat it too by getting this across by not focusing so much on the murders that happen. We know things are happening. We know, you know, things are not going well, but they don't really focus on the kill shots, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so he's kind of able to sidestep a lot of that, and it leads to crazy Nicolas Cage in the movie. And so the movie becomes, while striking this really bizarre horror film tone, is also giving us flashbacks to how basically this theme of how children, once they become teenagers, don't exactly listen to the parents, and how parents have basically given up on all their dreams to have children and have families. So when you see like what Nicolas Cage has felt that he's lost in his time.
Yeah.
I don't know if it becomes some sort of weird commentary on his own career and life, but you can read it like that, I suppose. But when you have Nicolas Cage, like, putting together a pool table and then busting it up while singing the Hokey Pokey, tell me you don't want to see that movie.
I do. Oh, yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's not as Brian Del Rico was sitting next to me and we watched it, and he said it's like it's kind of like half of a good movie, and they kind of filmed half of that.
Mm.
And he's not entirely wrong, but this movie reminded me of the kind of movies that we used to put on at the video store. We would just find some weird movie with some crazy performance or something that we just thought was just goofy and funny and put it on. And we knew it wasn't really a great movie, but we enjoyed the hell watching it.
Yeah, yeah.
That's exactly what this movie reminded me of. And I had a really good time watching this movie, mainly a lot because of Nicolas Cage. And I completely forgot who directed this movie until the credit came up at the end.
Yeah.
Brian Taylor.
Is Crank?
Yes. One half of the Crank
team. One half of the Crank team, yeah.
Yeah. So that's exactly what you're getting into when you see this movie.
All right, there you go. Mom and Dad, no release date on that one.
Not yet.
Okay, not yet. Okay. Eric, hang on, all right?
Okay.
All right, Eric Childress is with us, and we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to have more with Eric telling us more about the films that he saw at the Toronto Film Festival. And right now, we got to get to weather and traffic. And I've got the weather right here. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. Eric Childress is with us, and he's hanging out with us, telling us about some of the movies that he saw at the Toronto Film Festival last week. And we welcome Eric back. All right, welcome back, Eric.
Thank you.
Okay, where do you want to go next?
Did you know John Woo had a new movie?
Yes, I did. I heard about it.
Yeah. It's called Manhunt. And I saw it on the first night of the festival, and it's basically John Woo's The Fugitive.
Okay.
It's basically a hotshot lawyer gets framed for murder when a woman ends up dead in his bed. He ends up going on the run from the police. They have a sort of not so much a Tommy Lee Jones like character. I mean, an obsessed detective who basically specializes in, you know, tracking down really bad people. He gets on his case, then, you know, figure out that he's probably not the guy he's looking for. And then, the, you know, they both kind of team up to kind of put to bed the conspiracy that put this guy in, you know, the hot pursuit of all the police and gangsters and all kinds of things, and hitmen and hit women and all these kind of things. This is kind of John Woo at his most self-aware. I mean, there's this huge gag in this movie about doves. There are lines that, you know, say, you know, maybe there'll be a better tomorrow.
Come on, man.
No, I'm not joking. And if it was kind of a complete riff on his, like, greatest hits, that probably would have been a lot more fun than what we have here. Because, like, the plot is pretty ludicrous. The acting is not particularly strong. With the exception of a couple of sequences in the back half of the movie, it doesn't really the action sequences aren't that well put together. There are a couple moments towards the end that, you know, it's like, oh, this is John Woo. Here's the old John Woo that we really like.
Yeah.
But by then, it's kind of too little too late. We're a little too disengaged. At least I was with the film. And by the end, I was just kind of like, okay, enough already. And I just wanted to go home.
That's too bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. John Woo's Manhunt.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Where do you want to go next?
Well, let's go to Chappaquiddick.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I don't think I even need to explain what this movie is about.
I think I can figure it out from the title.
Yeah. This is the story of Ted Kennedy and the incident at Chappaquiddick when he drove off the bridge with the campaign, the woman that worked for his brother's campaign, who died in the accident, then it's about the cover up and how they him and his staff and his adopted brother. Ted Kennedy is played by Jason Clarke, by the way, mm-hmm. and his adopted brother is played by Ed Helms. And it's about the damage control. You know, Ted Kennedy pulls up from the from after the wreckage and says pretty bluntly, "I'm not going to be president."
Mm.
And you know, this is a movie. You know, last year at Toronto Festival, we saw Jackie, which I thought was one of the best movies of last year, and was another movie that was all about Camelot and legacy, and also about life and death. And this movie kind of feels like the anti Jackie, not so much in quality, because I think that it's a very watchable film. It's kind of interesting to see at least this perspective on it and see, you know, it's very kind of clinical and methodical in how it's going about, you know, giving you the cover-up story and how all the minds were in the room together. What do you got to say this, and what did you do this for, and you stupid idiot, and all these kind of things. And it doesn't really kind of leave you with anything. It kind of puts you, you know, like kind of like you're reading the facts of a book, but you don't really get any kind of great insight into the long-lasting legacy of this back half of the Kennedy legacy. That was, you know, kind of tarnished by this. But at the same time, you know, it ends with him, you know, he's known as the Lion of the Senate, and it doesn't really leave you with, like, you know, maybe this guy should have gotten a little bit more scrutiny than he actually got at the time. And so it's a watchable film, not a particularly strong film. If you saw it on cable, you probably wouldn't turn away from it, but not exactly something we're going to be remembering past once the credits roll.
Okay. Okay. All right. Let's do another one.
Speaking of real life events, Mary Shelley.
Okay.
Elle Fanning plays the author, Mary Shelley, and this is the period of her life before she wrote her most famous book. I believe it was called Wife Swappin'. it's a joke, but I'm being absolutely serious in that this movie has about as much to do with Frankenstein as, I don't know, fill in the metaphor there. I suppose they're probably trying to do something with connecting the dots between Mary Shelley being very interested in this young man who comes to her house to basically study under her father, who is a famous author, and wants, you know, doesn't really encourage her reading and writing, not in a bad way, just the norms of the time. And she's very much interested in books and writing. So the movie kind of delves into here and there about her, you know, fixing her writing and things like that, but it's mostly about this relationship she has with Mr. Shelley, and the kind of views that they have on marriage, and that they don't really want to get married, but if they do, they want it to be an open situation, and that leads to, you know, complications that just seem that could be right out of a modern day rom-com. That, you know, you take away the seriousness of this and put it into a wacky context, it just becomes some sort of treatise on marriage, and that's not really what you want to see a movie about Mary Shelley about. Even if it is the truth of the day, there has to be some sort of greater context to what exactly inspired her to write, you know, one of the great novels of all time. And this was a huge bore for me, and a huge disappointment, considering that the connections, you know, a lot of things you could connect the dots to today with in the treatment of women and I really dislike this movie.
Okay. All right. Well, that's too bad, because there's a great story in there. All right. Well, that's great. Now, so your favorite movie of the festival is Three Billboards Outside of Ebbing, Missouri, correct?
Yes. Yes, closely followed by Mother.
Closely followed by Mother, which nobody's going to see.
No.
All right. Well, I appreciate it all, all the stuff that you reported for us, man. And are you writing about this stuff online anywhere?
Not yet. I'm working on doing some more stuff with the podcast. We're going to do another radio show, probably a big segment on WHBK.
Okay.
Sergio Mims. We're probably going to do a lot of stuff, talk about a lot of stuff on the podcast.
Okay, cool. All right. Always a pleasure, Eric. I'll talk to you next week.
Sounds good.
Thanks, buddy. Okay, we got a break here. We got the news coming up next on WGN.